So I just want you to know that I recognize that there are many of you that are gluten-free folks in this congregation. And because my lovely wife is also gluten-free, we've done a lot of experimenting, and yeast can work on non-wheat flours as well. So we can make it rise in the same way, and I only share that with you because I really want you to think, be thinking on and aware of that metaphor. Of the addition of yeast, the leaven, which doesn't actually have to be yeast if you do sourdough bread. In fact, it can be just bacteria that are out there in the atmosphere that you attract in and you bring in. But they bring in those organisms, transform that bread. And I want you to think about that because I want us to think about some transformed lives. One in particular was of a person that we're familiar with who had what I would call an inherited faith. An inherited faith. He was a brilliant man, could have done almost anything with his life. At age 15, had graduated from high school. At age 19, had graduated from college. At age 22, had a master's degree. At age 25, had a PhD. The world, whatever the world would have allowed him, he could have done. But he is the grandson of a minister. A minister that had taken a struggling congregation of 13 people and had turned it into a mighty force within its community. He was the son of a minister who had taken over that church from grandfather and had continued to make that a powerful force in his community. And so ministry was sort of the family business, and so he went into the family business. And at age 25, not yet having finished his PhD, in process, all but done. That's not what ABD stands for, is it, actually? But good enough. He's called to his first church, little church in Montgomery, Alabama, 1955. He's called there to be a pastor of that church, actually in 1954. Young man, eloquent, but very, very green behind the ears, not knowing a whole lot about what it means to be a minister, but understanding that the Christian faith that he is proclaiming is a faith that can be used for social change, to utilize the stories of that faith, stories that are stories of liberation, stories of love that conquers all, stories and the words of prophets that speak to a society that would be just, that would overthrow the systems of domination. He understood that this faith that he could proclaim from a pulpit was in fact something that could be used for social change. And believe me, in the 1950s, he understood that social change needed to happen. He understood that he could couple that faith with the strategies of nonviolence that had been seen in India by Mahatma Gandhi and that others were advocating. And so, as he entered into this church as a young 25-year-old, still waiting to finish up his PhD, he made sure that every member of his church had registered to vote. He made sure that every member of his church was a member of the NAACP. He made sure that there was a social action and a peace committee within the life of his church. And then on December 1st, 1955, 18 months into his ministry, a woman by the name of Rosa Parks chose to not move her seat when she got onto a bus and was told to move to the back of the seat so that a white man could have her seat, and she refused to move her seat, and for that she was arrested. And that night, December 1st, 1955, the black community, the African-American community of Montgomery, Alabama, gathered together in Martin Luther, that young minister's church, and decided to create the Montgomery Improvement Association. And the Montgomery Improvement Association decided that what they were going to do was that they were going to institute, as a result of what had happened to Rosa Parks, a boycott of the Montgomery public transportation system. 4 days later, on December 5th, 1955, that boycott began. And this young preacher, this young 25-year-old man, Martin Luther King Jr., was asked to be the leader of that Montgomery Improvement Association. And he took that mantle seriously, knowing that he had the stories of his faith to back him up, knowing that they had a strategy that could be developed and could be used, and knowing that though they had little money, they did have some economic power, because 75% of all public transportation users were African Americans in Montgomery, Alabama. And if they stopped riding the bus, people would pay attention. And so on that day, on December 5th, that's exactly what began to happen. And they began to walk, they began to carpool. African-American taxi cab drivers offered their African-American community taxi fares at the same cost of the bus, 10 cents, rather than the normal taxi fare. And again, they began to see, or for the first time, they began to see that all of a sudden there was power, and they had the stories of their faith to back it up with them. Of course, didn't sit well with the majority white population in Montgomery, Alabama. And the lightning rod for them became this young black man who was the voice of the Montgomery Improvement Association. Within a month, Martin Luther King Jr. was receiving 40 death threats a day on his telephone. Death threats to him, death threats to his wife, death threats to his first child, young daughter. And just 40, 50 days into it, January 27th, he was already in a place of despair. Already in a place of utter despair, because he feared for not only his life, but the life of his wife, the life of his daughter. And on that night, he received yet another phone call that said, "Stop this boycott or you will die." And the fear of lynching was very clear and very evident. And with his wife asleep, his daughter asleep, he rummaged around the house, pulling out his hair, trying to figure out how to move forward. And he writes in his first book that he wrote, Strides of Freedom, he writes these words. He says, "In this state of exhaustion, when my courage had all but gone, I decided to take my problem to God. With my head in my hands, I bowed over the kitchen table and I prayed aloud." And he goes on to say, "The words I spoke to God that midnight are still vivid in my memory. I am here," he says to God, "taking a stand for what I believe is right. But now I am afraid. The people are looking to me for leadership. And if I stand before them without strength and courage, they too will falter. I am at the end of my powers. I have nothing left. I've come to the point where I cannot face it alone," he says. "And at that moment, I experienced the presence of the divine as I had never experienced God before. It seemed as though I could hear the quiet assurance of an inner voice saying, 'Stand up for justice, stand up for truth, and God will be at your side forever.' Almost at once," he writes, "my fears began to go. My uncertainty disappeared, and I was ready to face anything." At that moment, what he calls his kitchen table conversion, Dr. Martin Luther King Jr.'s faith shifted from an inherited faith to a transformational faith. That God met him that day at the kitchen table, right where he was, speaking to who he was, and God began to rearrange the very spirit of the person from inside out. The man who rose on his knees at that time had the same flesh and blood as the man who had gone down on his knees when he began his prayer, but his spirit had been rearranged, had been transformed by his interaction with the very presence of God. And it is that interaction, that restoring, that rearranging of his spirit that allowed him now to take the actions that he had believed in, to now take those actions without fear and to, in fact, be a new person. And I read that and I think that's not that dissimilar to the stories that we've been hearing of the first appearances of the risen Christ to the disciples. Last week we talked about Mary in the garden, in despair, in agony, and she sees and hears Jesus call to her, call her by name, Mary. And she knows that he is alive. And at that moment, her inherited faith, that of the Judaism that had been passed on for millennium, became a transformed faith. And she became a transformed person. And when she goes back to the upper room to go talk to the boys there in the upper room, she shares with them what she has experienced. And it still doesn't sink in until that evening when Jesus appears to them. And no longer is the appearance story one of him calling by name as he did with Mary. Instead, the appearance story is one where he simply says, "Peace be with you." And because males tend to be very tactile, he breathes upon them. And it is that breathing of the Spirit upon them that transforms their spirit from within. And they too now are different people, same flesh and blood, but utterly different people. And a week later, as was read to us just a few moments ago, there is Thomas, and amazing. Here are the other disciples who've experienced the risen Christ, who that's, I'm sure, all they can talk about. And Thomas is saying, "You know, I really would like to see this too, but I haven't seen it yet." And yet he's still hanging around. He's not feeling like I'm not welcome here or anything else. He just hasn't had the experience. And so that night, one week later, Jesus comes again, speaks to Thomas. And this time, if you remember, with Mary, he says, "Don't touch me. Don't touch me yet." With Thomas, he says, "Go ahead, touch. Touch me. See where the wounds were." And so Thomas, because God comes to us where we are and where our need is, what Thomas needed was to know the presence of Christ in that way. Paul is a very different person. Paul the persecutor. Paul needed to be slapped upside the head, blinded on a road. There, lying on the side of the road, quivering, he hears a voice. "Why are you persecuting me, Paul? Why are you doing this?" And that's the moment that Paul understands and recognizes and experiences the presence of God, and he becomes transformed and changed. And we are not sitting here in these chairs, in this beautiful space, if it were not for those transformational experiences of the presence of God in those first disciples 2,000 years ago. Though the church is still struggling with the concept of inclusiveness, Mary and many of the other women in the early church were the ones that in fact demonstrated that the church, the way of God, the people of God, the community of God, the beloved community, has no male or female, no Jew nor Greek, no free nor slave. There were women right there in leadership positions, and we are the inheritors of that. Peter, my goodness, Peter, that one who was quivering and denying Jesus just a few days before, is now the one that goes to the heart of the empire, goes direct to Rome, and allows the church to take on the Roman Empire right in the beast of the belly. Thomas, we are told by legend, went all the way to India, and that the first Christians in India became Christians because the good news that they heard was from Thomas, who had touched the risen Christ. And Paul went everywhere. Paul went everywhere with the good news. And because of that, because each of them had an experience in where from within their spirit was rearranged and they were transformed, they moved forward without fear and they began to change the world. Just like Martin Luther King. 3 days after his kitchen table conversion, a bomb explodes outside of his house, 1956, Montgomery, Alabama. Shatters a portion of the house. Crowds begin to, as soon as the word is heard that the bomb has exploded, crowds begin to gather there, and they are angry, and they want vengeance, as you can well imagine. And Martin Luther King writes these words, "Strangely enough, I accepted the word of the bombing calmly. My religious experience, my transformational experience, a few nights before, had given me the strength to face it." And then, let's say, standing on that broken porch in front of people who wanted nothing more than blood vengeance for what had happened, he says these words: "We must meet hate with love. Remember, 1956, he says this, if I am stopped, the movement will not stop because God is with this movement. Go home, glorious faith and radiant assurance." And they did. And the violence did not happen that night, although there were those that were yearning for it, because he reassured them with the faith that just three nights before had transformed him, that there was a different way. And no longer was Christianity for him a force just for social change in which the stories and the words of the prophet could be used to galvanize a people. No longer was nonviolence just a way that was a strategy that could be used. Indeed, indeed, these were now parts of the internal makeup of the human being. These were parts of a spirit transformed, and because of that, the world pivoted as well. The gospel of nonviolence that he preached expanded. It took another 328 days in Montgomery before that boycott ended, but by that time the movement had gone long beyond Montgomery. By that time the movement had spread itself into other cities in the South where racism was enshrined in laws, but soon that movement went beyond the South, and it began to move north and west and east, places like Chicago and Los Angeles, places like Washington, D.C., and national laws, the Civil Rights Act of 1964, the Voting Rights Act of 1965, came out of that. And what people began to experience, though, in the 60s was that the racism that was enshrined in laws actually existed deeply in the hearts of many others, though the laws might not have reflected that. And there was opposition every step along the way. And there's no question that Martin Luther King faltered at times. But there's also no question that he continued to return to that kitchen table, continued to return to that place of prayer, continued to return to that where God had transformed him and that he could therefore move forward. So by 1967, 1 year to the day before he was assassinated, he was standing in that great UCC church in New York City, Riverside Church, and he stood there and he connected the dots that it is no longer about racism that we must deal with, because racism is part of a triple axis of evil: racism, rampant materialism, and militarism. And I cannot stand here, he said, to advocate nonviolence while our nation is wreaking violence on the other side of the world in Vietnam. The movement had moved from a bus boycott to a movement to change the world. And what he began to talk to his people about was that soon we were going to have to move beyond, even while there were those that were denigrating him, while there were those that doubted his methodology, while there were those that said this cannot be. He continued to faithfully believe that the work still needed to be done, and that the work of love that had transformed his heart could transform a world. The work of nonviolence could change the world. And he began to talk about how this movement was going to have to transcend color, was going to have to transcend national boundaries, was going to have to change a world. He died before he could see that happen. He died, but a torch has passed. A torch is lit and a torch has passed, and the torch has passed even to us this day. It is not a torch that is just about strategy any more than riding on a donkey into Jerusalem while the imperial army is coming in through another gate is really a strategy for social change. Any more than a ragtag group of folks going into the beast of the belly in Rome and calling for the world to be turned upside down is a strategy for change. It is a torch that is not a torch about strategy, but first and foremost, it is about an encounter with the divine, an encounter with the presence of God, an encounter with love that can transform us from within. And from that transformation from within, then all of our actions are able to be done in a way without fear, with knowledge of God's presence with us, and going forward with strength and with courage to fight the fight for peace and justice in ways that embrace all that is love, all that is aloha. It is from these encounters, whether it be a woman in a garden hearing her name, a group of men in an upper room hearing peace be upon you, a gentleman with his hand being able to touch a wounded hand, a person in prayer at a kitchen table, wherever those encounters may be, those encounters where we allow the presence of the divine to enter into ourselves and so enter in, change us so that we go from that hard tack of a cracker to that risen bread filled with life, filled with energy, filled with substance that is beyond our imagination. It doesn't begin with our intellect. It doesn't begin with our knowledge of strategy. It begins with our heart being burst open, God's presence rushing in. And then we bring the gifts of intellect, we bring the gifts of strategy, we bring the gifts of will, and we bring all of that to the table. And the world shifts and pivots because we have allowed ourselves to be open to that very presence. Amen.